This is a production of Cornell University.
UA meeting April 30th, 2010. UA meeting April 30th, 2010.
I don't know how we properly do this, whether there needs to be...
I endorse the recommendation to extend his...
Second.
Thank you. Is there discussion? Hearing no discussion, all in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Abstaining? Once again, unanimous. My gosh, we've made some progress here. How about the appointment of the JCC? There's a list of folk, and I have not cut to the quick here.
I have the one here for
The Judicial Codes Council.
For Kyle Hogan.
Yeah, just one name.
You mean Kyle?
Okay. Just one.
Just one name.
Yeah.
So, do I hear a motion to approve this recommendation?
I move we approve the recommendation.
Thank you, Marty. You're wonderful.
I second.
Is there a discussion? Hearing no discussion, all in favor? All opposed? All abstaining? All right.
Hearing and review boards. That's the one with many names.
Yeah. Right. And how do we proceed with that? It's going to make sense. There is a recommendation, but I couldn't find it.
Sure. The recommendation is in the resolution.
Yes, Leon.
Also, the number, like where it says 50 members, and then it talks about 55, so we got to decide which one is correct.
It's 25 in place of 20, and 55 in place of 50. In other words, we're
25 students.
Increasing the number of students to 25, and the number of total number is 55 from 50 to count to 5 students.
Yeah. Right.
So
right.
It matches the resolution we call.
That's right. Yeah.
So we have a resolution that is presented to us. I don't think it needs to be a second, does it? Well, if it does, anybody second it? Thank you, Randy. So, any discussion? Well, hearing no discussion.
And this is, we're voting also on the term of fraud and the appointment change.
No, this is just the resolution approving nominations to university hearing and review boards.
Oh, okay. Wait a minute. We're talking about the one with the scoring.
Yes.
All right.
Kate already presented, and I think we already approved
it. Yeah, we already approved it. Okay. So on this change then, from 20 to 25 and from 50 to 55,
right.
That's what we're voting on.
Right. Just part four?
Yeah.
It's just part four.
Be it therefore resolved.
Yeah, changing those numbers to reflect.
That's my understanding.
Yeah. Okay. There are edits on the front, which is why I was confused. Yeah. Those are already previously adopted?
No, we haven't
gone on the front.
There's two different ones on the front page.
Sorry, can you
send
anybody on that?
I don't have a copy of it. So.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm looking at what was sent.
That's what I was looking at.
Two pages were confused there.
Okay. Yes.
The front page goes with another page.
I'm talking about one that says, be it therefore resolved that Title II, Article 4, Paragraph C1 of the Code, be amended as follows. The right. University Hearing Board and University Review Board tool.
Right.
The piece of paper that you got today is a conflation of two different...
Mm-hmm.
We are not voting on the one that's on the first page, or the face page.
Right. We're
voting on the second page that ends with respectfully submitted. We haven't yet come to the first one, which is about
so we got this.
Okay.
We'll be with you in just a moment. Please join us.
I'm so apologetic. I'm sorry.
No problem.
I'm trying to propose something good for the faculty, and I think I got it done. But
good.
That's hard to break with the conversation, so I apologize.
I move that we accept this resolution to change the number from 50 to 55 and 20 to 25.
I second.
Okay, we have moved and seconded. Any further discussion? All in favor of this motion?
Great.
All opposed to this motion?
No.
Anybody abstaining?
Fine.
We've done it.
All right.
President Scorton.
Very much sure.
About the
you said you were going to pass.
Oh, but I acknowledge it, right? Yeah, I did pass it. Very interesting. I didn't follow the whole thing. Very interesting. I forgot the first thing. It
was an unusual one. Yeah. He won the prize.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah. Sorry to put long to look at you. How are you?
You presumably know most of us, and we all are equipped with names.
Then there's similar names to the last time we were together. Attached to the same people.
Probably.
Except Leon, I don't recognize him. Leon, thank you for having me at the Thursday thing.
Okay.
Thanks for having me at the Thursday
thing. Oh, you're welcome.
I really enjoyed it.
My name is Denzel Washington.
Yeah.
Now cool. I'm Leon again.
I appreciate you doing that. That was a lot of fun.
Okay.
So, do you have anything you'd like to share with us particularly, or should we ask questions, or how?
Yeah, you can ask questions. I do apologize to be so late, but I was doing something for the greater good. I'm glad to answer questions.
The question I would like to start with is, has there been any recovery in the major gifts to the university, would you say?
Well, that's what I was just doing now, as a matter of fact. Let's see. There's three pieces of data relevant to that question. One,
positive, very positive.
So I think you're great. I think so. Sorry, this is all part of the same effort. There's three pieces of philanthropy, just to remind you. There's people promising to give money, pledges. There's people fulfilling the pledges. Usually those go together and are tightly correlated, but in times of duress, you worry about a divergence of those where somebody in all good faith made a promise 5 years ago and things are terrible now. And we have not seen a divergence here. People who have made pledges are fulfilling them by and large on time to the letter of the deal, which is huge. Because we do a lot of things based on those promises, established professorships, scholarships, build buildings, things like that. The second piece of it is cash contributions for use that year, not to be put in the endowment, but to immediately go to use that year. And we're actually up in that regard. So we were up in that regard 2 years ago because of some enormous gifts at the medical school. We were up last year even more than the year before once those gifts were already part of the baseline. So, and the third piece is new pledges, and we're way down in new pledges. Everyone in the country is way down because people are very nervous about giving mega, mega pledges. It's hard.
Yeah.
So people have kept the faith with us on promises. They have kept the faith in terms of cash contributions for current use funding in a way that's actually really astonishing. I don't think that's an exaggeration. And new pledges, people are nervous because of the not only their own personal means have retreated, but they're uncertain about the robustness of the stock market and so on and so forth. So on the third area, the area where we're looking for recovery, we are beginning to see some. And this thing I'm working on today is very promising. An alum who is very loyal, say very engaged with Cornell, wants to help us now, believes that that the family will be able to help us, and so is here today meeting with faculty and students. And my philosophy is to get them to meet with the people who are actually, you know, doing the real stuff that they want to invest in, so to speak. And it's very, very positive. So I think we're just beginning to turn the corner on that third
Yeah. Thank you so much. Other questions for the president? Randy?
So I'd like to talk about the biology. So the university assembly has an interest, not in the curriculum per se, but in the process, and make sure the process is fair. And the only reason that I filed a grievance with the faculty senate and CAP was because you took so long to respond. And then your response led us to a website that had nothing to do with the BCTC. So I would like you to actually approve that resolution.
Okay, well, I'm not going to do anything today. I'll have to go back and look at your response. I can't apologize too strongly for the fact that things are taking me longer. It's just the way my life is right now.
We can believe that.
And it's not for lack of interest. I also don't let people ghostwrite those things. I want to see it. They can draft them off for me. I want to be sure I understand what's going on. I can't imagine I sent you an irrelevant website, but if I did, I'm embarrassed about that. I won't engage with you on stuff that's in the provost domain that has to do with the interaction of local faculty, governance, and so on. I'll go back and make sure that I look at it and get you a decent answer on it, and I'll do my best to stay in time with your resolutions, but I'm not going to make any promises without going back to people who actually know what they're talking about. I do think it's important that the faculty locally are in charge of the curriculum and not a broader body. But if, as was suggested in your email to me, if you believe that there's been some rupture of normal process, I'll go back and try to put it together. But I'm not saying there hasn't been. I'm saying your allegation is that there hasn't been. I'll look into it. I promise you I'll do that. And the reason I'm not taking notes on it is that Charlie very graciously laid out the argument and the assertion, and I'm looking into it. So I will. And thanks for doing it. And I always appreciate the stuff that you send me. I take everybody seriously.
Regarding your signing on with other presidents for the international students that graduate and want to remain as professionals as U.S. citizens, could you talk just a little bit about that?
That's got a little bit of a personal nature to it because I'm a first-generation American, but let's see. So how can I start this? Within the big universe of immigration issues that sorely need a scrubbing in our country, in my opinion, I've been active in a lot of higher ed immigration issues for some years. I'm on a committee that the don't go running out of here when I tell you this, but I'm on a committee appointed by the director of the FBI. There's 20 university presidents, to publicly visible committee called the National Security Higher Education Advisory Board. We meet with the FBI and CIA and so on, State Department, about immigration issues and other things relevant to higher education. And there's a group of presidents, 20 of us, pushing very hard on immigration issues and trying to retain our ability as faculty members to attract and educate and also learn from scholars and students from all over the world while being cognizant of security kind of issues. So within that general area, which tends to be aimed at Asia and areas that are of supposed security concerns and real security concerns, there is a problem that's become more and more and more relevant and more apparent, and that is that children of undocumented international visitors to the U.S. who have been here throughout the K-12 system or at least throughout the secondary school system, who finish in prep school, secondary school, which is in their prep schools, and are not eligible for entry with financial aid, are not able to pursue avenues for permanent citizenship or even permanent residency and eventually naturalized citizenship. And they're in the country not through their own fault. They were brought by their parents, and they're caught between a rock and a hard place. There's no way that they can take advantage of student loans or go to schools. Some schools, they have a preference for citizens. and yet they're in the country. And so the DREAM Act, many of us are supporting it, is really twofold in purpose. One is to allow a path to permanent residency, and the second one is to allow a path to higher education. And I'm a strong believer, from my own experience in life, that higher education is a way for people to become contributors to society in a different way, separate in addition to the worthwhile nature of learning things for its own sake. And so I was able to get the CUNY system, the SUNY system, Buffalo, Stony Brook, Syracuse, NYU, Fordham, and I think Rochester, I think those are the schools, to sign on with me, and we're doing some encouragement of our government to actually pursue immigration reform writ large, and also to get this thing done. Are you all supportive of that? I'm just curious.
What was my 11 to 10 and 12?
Are you all supportive?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you anybody not supportive?
I have
questions
about, but I don't
know.
You know, I can.
Well, we can do it offline if you want.
But I wonder if this might be, if this large revision from the top through, if this might be a compromise that would be possible, because it would affect a much smaller number of people.
Sure.
I am curious about, because I've heard conflicting, you know, it's being debated. I heard Lori Banks from numbers on CBS here tonight. And some people are claiming that it's very loosely worded, and that in fact anybody could come over here as long as they're under 30 years old and then, you know, take advantage of these things. Do you know, is there a time period that one must have lived in this country, or an age by which one must have been brought here by one's family?
There are boundaries around a lot of the activities, but it's a fiercely contested but bipartisanly supported bill. It's such a rarity these days. And I have no doubt that things will change by the time it gets through. I would consider it a victory if we found some way to allow the right subset of people to pursue higher education with full rights and ability to get help in the country, and to people who are very potentially productive members of this country to be there. It also sends a very good message to the rest of the world that, you know, this is still the, I mean, except for Native Americans, we're all immigrants in this country. It might be four generations ago, it might be one generation ago, like me. So I have no illusions that it would end up, even if it passed the way it is now, but I think it's worth trying to pursue. I take your meaning, though, as so often, Elizabeth, it's very unlikely with all this very comprehensive immigration reforms that we go through as laid out now. I think it's almost entirely predictable that, especially during a bad recession, people are going to be very nervous by competition for jobs across the income spectrum. But I do think it would be good to try to do something along this line. Maybe this is the only piece that gets through, like you're suggesting.
Are there other questions around the table and in the room?
Sorry, I'm so sorry that I'm late. I'm probably running beyond my welcome. I can tell you a tiny bit of how we're doing on campus in terms of the things that are happening. We're in the very final stages of forming up the freshman class of 2014, and it's very, very promising so far. The current freshman class, the most racially diverse class in the history of the university, and I hope we do even better. It's not clear yet, because everybody hasn't decided where to go, but we're ahead of where we were last year in terms of acceptances. I don't know the exact date on that. Peggy, you can find out.
May 1st is the deposit deadline.
Yeah. And so, anyway, it's interesting. On Cornell days, I made myself, as available as I possibly could be. And a lot of people wanted to talk about the suicides and the climate on campus. And the openness of the faculty senate and the non-faculty members of the faculty and departments to begin to engage on the classroom climate, advising, grading, academic calendar. It almost doesn't even matter exactly what's happened, but the fact that it's being taken on as a discussion topic. Very, very positive. People know it, and I'm making sure people know it. I would say on the student front, I think we're doing well. It's still troubling to me that even though we raise tuition on the endowed portion of the university, which is most of it, the lowest in 42 years, 2 years in a row. Still, those raises were 1.7, 1.8 times the rate of inflation. And so we're still slowly escalating across the higher ed, but at least much less than we were. And I remind myself all the time, and when I was with the SA yesterday and in general, that students are bearing the biggest brunt of balancing the budget, because 38% of the budget on this campus is tuition, amazingly. And it's going up, and student numbers are big. But I think we're doing a lot because people are applying here. Excellent people. And the student piece of the shared governance is very robust. On the staff side, it's been a very hard time for the staff. And we're down a touch over 7% in the staff workforce from the beginning of the recession till now. And we'll go down a bit more. But we're almost past that now. And so I'm happy to say that we're coming to the end of that period of having to have elimination of vacant lines, which makes more work for everybody, some layoffs. So we're making good progress in that regard. The engagement by the Bain company, I believe, has been very successful. And a lot of the savings, not all, unfortunately, but a lot of the savings from that are happening without personnel actions, especially in procurement. It'll remain for us to come together as a community, but especially the faculty, and find a way to live through the transition to a really robust, slick procurement system in order to save enough money to have fewer layoffs, just to be blunt about it. And we have to make the system good enough that you can use it. And there's a lot of work being done in that regard. On the faculty side, it does keep me up. I'm not trying to be dramatic that we're still not hiring faculty at the appropriate rate. And so what I'm doing in these philanthropic efforts now, we've got a good start on student financial aid. We're staying the course on very robust undergraduate financial aid. We've begun to do better on international undergraduate financial aid. And now I'm working very, very close to full time of my time in philanthropy and faculty hiring, and finding different ways and mechanisms where that might occur. And the sooner we return to a vigorous pace of faculty hiring, not only will it stabilize the place, really stabilize it, and stabilize it in terms of people's attitudes, I believe, but I think there are some faculty to be hired that we would find it harder to hire at a time where other schools were more robust in their own hiring. In other words, we could do better in the market right now if we could be aggressive about hiring in selected areas of the university. So trying to find a nice place to do that. And we share some ideas on some areas of the university that especially need to have the hiring made more robust, but I'm finding that. I'm finding some of the alumni are willing, even if they're not able to help us with large permanent endowments, are willing to help us with the cash flow that would have come from such endowment. So, at a 5% yield, if someone can give us $1 million for a scholarship, which covers a full ride for a student, one student a year forever, $50,000 a year, I'm finding some folks who will give us $50,000 a year for 4 years, which has the same effect on one student's life as if he or she had given us $1 million. And then gives me 4 years to talk to them, about turning it into an endowment. And so I'm doing that now on the faculty side as well, seeing if it's possible to find a cash flow equivalent to a professorship. It would be great if possible for that not to be out in public minutes, because it's a tactic that I'm using.
Well,
I'm
on a recording, unfortunately. I will make
okay.
The delta.
Okay.
Marty?
I wonder if you could... If we're talking about recruitment and efforts, getting a full student body and so forth, you talk about issues that people bring up and discuss about the suicide problems and things that they see in the papers. I'm wondering what is it in particular about Cornell that, is there any way of assessing what in particular about Cornell is appealing to a student who as an alternative to going somewhere else, another Ivy League school. I just, as a part of the course I was having, for the fun of it, showed a Yale recruitment musical mashup kind of thing. And they sell themselves in a particular way, having to do with the way the campus is organized, where it is, even New Haven and so forth. And I felt for the 38 years I've been here that Cornell has a lot of things that are specific here that are terrifically appealing, that I wouldn't want to have changed because to try and make it more, whatever, competitive with some other abstract view of what it is. So, pardon me?
There's no evidence that we're doing that.
No, I'm not accusing anybody, but I'm curious as to whether whether students, whether families, and so on, there's a way of assessing what in particular might appeal about Cornell to students, and they're enhancing that. I mean, that's one pocket of interest I have, and then the other pocket is about whether, as a part of the reimagining program, I mean, I know it's very complex and involves assessing through various committees and things of that sort, but whether there is some kind of specifically core Cornell identity that is trying to be preserved. We're a rural campus. We're in a rural area. There are a lot of virtues to that that could be lost were we to try and reimagine ourselves as some competitive suburban environment. We have this diversity of programs. It would be a shame to reimagine ourselves in ways that didn't continue to capitalize on that diversity and the cross-disciplinary side of it. Those kinds of things come to my mind.
Yeah. Well, those are complicated, big questions. They're hard to answer without taking too much time. Students are better witnesses than I am on what brings students to Cornell, but I ask students that a lot because I spend a lot of time with students. And what students tell me are three things. They tell me if you buy this or not. They tell me that the decision of where to go is very individual and almost intangible at times, very hard to quantify, but that, I guess that's one factor. In other words, not that it defies categorization and analysis, but that a lot of it is the aggregation of personal experience, family, how the thing strikes you, who you meet when you're on the campus, the kind of stuff that it might be very hard to generalize. Is that fair? The second thing is that the comprehensive nature of the offerings and the possibility of changing one's mind and having a huge likelihood that you can land on your feet somewhere else in excellent discipline without having to go across the country, I've been told is a good thing. Am I doing all right so far?
Yeah.
Okay. And the third one that I've been told has to do with the environment here that allows a lot of choice in the non-classroom aspect of campus. That there's 800 student organizations, and students can usually find a way of doing what they want and finding some sort of way to support it or make it happen. And then if you don't like one of the 800 student groups, there's at least a fighting chance that you can develop something else on your own. And that there's a whole gamut from linking to a particular faculty member who, say, is interested in gamelan music or just makes something up. And, you can find
it's
that.
It's not made up, it's real.
I know. but that idea that you could, outside the classroom and laboratory and studio, develop an environment of growth for yourself where you're learning from other students and faculty advisors to an interest group. Even though you're not studying with that faculty as you're teaching, that funny calculus, there's something about Cornell that's appealing. And so those are the three things that I'm told the most often. I'm not counting legacy things or parents saying that you can go wherever you want, but I'll pay for Cornell. See, in my family, it was we can't afford you can go wherever you want as long as you go somewhere. And so that's what I'm told. The most vigorous, just to remind you, I know you know this, I don't mean to be pedantic, but just to remind you, the most vigorous work in reimagining stuff is all being done on the administrative side, looking at how we're organized for facilities, IT, procurement, HR, communications, finance, these things that I think should be, hopefully, will be invisible to these kind of considerations of the students. They won't be invisible to the faculty in terms of procurement, but I mean, in general, they won't interact with that, curricular and the magic that we're talking about. But there's always a danger that you could get reimagining fever, you know, mm-hmm. and sort of start to reimagine all kinds of things. And that's why when I gave their State of the U address, whether it was effective or not, I'm not saying, I tried to rehash what I thought were the four pillars in Cornell, you know, the faculty independence and the classical and contemporary inquiry and student access and public engagement, that we should not walk away from those things. The last thing I'll tell you about the students, however, is that it's become clearer and clearer to me as the school is becoming more diverse that now that we have the, now that we're in the right ballpark on financial aid, still not all the way there, but we're in the right ballpark. Three out of the five quintiles of families below the top level of income, three of the five quintiles below that, it now costs less to go to Cornell than it did 10 years ago, less. That's how much financial aid we have. But now that we've done that, it's clear, and you tell me if this is right or wrong, that it's necessary but not sufficient to have that money. That the other support services, Leon graciously had me with OMEA a couple Thursdays ago, or a week ago Thursday, and I had another opportunity to interact with students in that setting and so on, that there's a lot of things we have to add on now as we come out of the doldrums and recession to make sure that once the students are recruited through those different means, and once we have more students here who have not had college experience in the family or from groups that are not represented broadly, that we have to pay even more attention to student support, not only formal student support services, but everything from advising to what to do if somebody's having trouble, not wait till the trouble gets to the point where they're falling off the table and so on. And that's the next phase of emphasis for me, is to try to do that so that we're fulfilling our promise that the kids have come here. Because I think we're over the hump if we can maintain it on the balance between tuition and financial aid. It's much, much better than it was now, thanks to Biddy. And so, you know, it's a matter of just keeping it up.
Any other comments, Ed?
I just wanted to, those three points that you mentioned for students, obviously apply more to undergrad than to grad students.
I'm sorry, that's what I thought you were talking about.
Yeah, I just wanted to emphasize also faculty, as far as grad students are concerned.
Oh, no.
I mean, for me, that was the only thing I cared about when I
Yeah, grad students, now. Another whole world. That whole GCI has to be brought back to life. And it's a whole another world. Remember, that's the only world I came from. I came from graduate professional education. I had some undergrads in my lab, but that wasn't my experience. And so, yeah, no, we have huge amounts to do. And I'm sorry, I was only talking about the undergrad thing. So perhaps I misunderstood. I thought
that's what I was talking about.
Yeah.
No, the graduate thing is enormous. And postdocs is something not to be forgotten either. If we tend to spend, I believe, less time talking about postdocs, which in some fields of campus are becoming hugely, hugely important in the operations, research operations. And the research now is going through the roof even more because you all have been so successful with the ARRA money. It's breathtaking how much faculty throughout the university has brought $240 million, something like that, in ARRA money.
But the problem is there's going to be an end to that. And
in the meantime, though, here it is.
Oh, yeah.
Cash on the barrel head. You guys are using it. Students are being supported. Staff are being supported. Work's being done. And in the meantime, the federal agencies are getting funded. It's not going down.
Yeah.
Well, it's Obama. And also the mood of the Congress worried about the American pipeline of science discipline. I'll tell you, the one area where we're striking out as a country is in the national endowments. We're still going nowhere fast.
Yeah.
And the budget brought out, a revenue budget, you know, raised the NIH by, I don't want to give the wrong number, $2 billion, something like that. And other agencies, you know, held stable. And the NEH reduced by $5.6 million. Million dollars. Not even a rounding error.
Yeah.
Maybe not invisible, you know. And in the halcyon days of the National Endowment for the Humanities, two-thirds of the support available for humanities scholarship in the country was from the NEH. But the NEA was never that way. The NEA was always a relatively small contributor to academic research. A lot of it was being used to support production companies and orchestras and art and so on, which is very important. But in terms of academia, both are important. NE is very important. So I'm back on the trail again, lobbying for the NEH. And the current chair of the NEH is an old, very close friend of mine, Jim Leach, who was congressperson from Iowa for a long time. His daughter worked in my wife's lab. And he can't lobby, of course, but we're working on seeing if it's possible to bring that back up. Just think about that. $5.6 million reduced. It's unbelievable. During the 140.
On what kind of base, though?
150 million.
150. Oh wow.
Yeah, and there was 175 million during the 104th Congress during a flap about some artwork, Mapplethorpe flap. Those endowments went down 44% in 1 year by a stroke of the pen, and they were only 175 million to start with. 175 million.
Yeah.
And the NEH is 30 billion. So I'm not saying we shouldn't spend money on biomedical research. I'm going to live forever because of biomedical research. Maybe not, but the NEH, I mean, it's unbelievable.
So. Makes it worth it.
It's true. No, it really is true. By the way, the chair of the NEH now is a fascinating man. I'm trying hard to get on the campus this fall. And he's, you can imagine from being many, many, many terms a congressperson, that he knows his way around the Beltway. And the head of the NEA is a Broadway producer who's very good at presenting his case. So might be that the wind will be at our backs again.
Yeah.
I hope so.
Well, thank you.
Elizabeth, any questions?
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, I don't know how long you have to do this.
Maybe this is the last one.
Yeah.
And I would put in a plug for those of us who are not in the sciences and aren't eligible for these big grants. Science is wonderful, but, you know, if we don't have good government, we're all screwed. And I, you know, in my own department, it's the time of the year when students are desperately looking for research relationships with faculty, and it's one of the best things that we do here, and there's so little money for it. And so many students who want to do it, who want to be research assistants, and I have such close relationships with students, and there's such a tiny, you know, my research account is 4,000 a year, that's all I have. A couple of professional meetings, that's all gone.
Do you have external support? Do you have external support, NSF support?
Nope, and I applied to the social science thing, and they turned me down, because I forgot to attach my resume. Anyway, it's another story.
finish the question. Please.
Well, they said that I wish there were more money to work with students and to do research with students, for those of us who are not in sciences and don't have labs, because just it means so much to them. It's such a wonderful relationship. But my real question is much bigger than all this, but it's linked to all of it. I wonder where we're going structurally. I just supervised a marvelous honors thesis on the way financial crises in the United States have led to the augmentation of executive power. And I couldn't help but think, yeah, that's happening at Cornell, too.
Well, how can you say that?
Because the provost has asked for really extraordinary control of budget.
Oh, that's not accurate, Elizabeth. I'm sorry. I'm agreeing with my reviews, but that's not accurate.
This is something we discussed in the Senate that I missed the last meeting.
Bring the discussion back. Was anybody at Don Randall's lecture?
No.
Don Randall was here lecturing. You were there?
Yeah.
Did you hear his discussion at the end about how terrible it is to have responsibility center management?
Mm-hmm.
His view is that the budget model is way too distributed back to the colleges, back to the faculty. So if you look very carefully at the budget model, it's an outside person, has no investment here. An outside, person who's 32 years at Cornell, knows the place well, he's worried about just the opposite of what you're saying. This budget is very much in the direction of control of resources at the collegiate level. Very much. The fact that tuition would be rounded up and then redistributed according to need will be in the service of the colleges. It's not a grab for college. That's
well, I hope, but the idea that the provost is taking control of all, and we had somebody sit here
and
explain that the provost also is going to tax, that was his word, 15% off the top of all incoming revenues, as he put it, from golf courses.
Oh, gosh. We have to.
Never mind. I don't even want to make that the main thing. But my big issue here has always been deliberation. I don't think the reimagining effort has had much deliberation. All the committees, all the task forces were centrally appointed, and people, I remember somebody saying in the Faculty Senate when we were talking particularly about the library task forces became controversial, like, you know, why do we think faculty should have anything to do with this? Because in fact, they haven't, and these were centrally appointed.
So this
boards.
Is the first time.
So I'm afraid of it, that the financial crisis is going to lead to even more centralization problems. My real question is, which is much more specific, the Faculty Senate has proposed some structural changes in governance that would give the faculty more of a role, going back to something it had some decades ago when it had a much stronger role in policy making at the university. And we also passed a resolution, that's something that passed, we also passed a resolution on budgeting, because a lot of us saw disaster coming with the overbuilding and the overcommitment, and we were afraid of where we were going to end up. And it's terrible to be right about that, but the devastating consequences of all that debt incurred that now are cutting into faculty and research and graduate admissions and everything, and libraries and everything we do here. So, I mean, the faculty resolution was about having some kind of broader deliberative process to really centralize. And I'm talking about more centralization, but to a larger group, not just one person, not just a provost,
okay.
But on which faculty, selected by the faculty, not appointed from the top, will actually have something to say about money and about committing funds to the project.
Sure. Okay. So you just told me two things that, and you know I have great respect for you, so permit me to treat you with enough respect to be straightforward with you. You just told me two things that are completely in opposite directions. You start off by telling me, let's have some more money for the social sciences. Only way something like that would happen is if somebody near the top decided, okay, I'm going to grab some money and give it to the social sciences. If you put that out for a faculty vote, you're going to see how many science faculty you have here, how many in biological sciences, physical sciences, math, handful of people in the arts, two handfuls of people in the humanities, a lot of numbers, but not people with numerical, control of money. And then you're going to have some social scientists in the middle, some of which can apply to the SDE director or the NSF, many who can't. So on the one hand, you want, and I completely agree with you, you want some judgment from the view of someone who has a broad view of campus of what's needed. And I cannot agree more, but unless there's the ability to say, here's a piece of campus that's falling off the table, like was done with financial aid, or what might be done with social sciences when Biddy brought in the social science group to look at things, the Henry Bean, the former Cornellian, brought this Rumpf group in to look at. That's on the one hand. And I think that's absolutely accurate. On the other hand, you say, which I think is also accurate, that there has to be a place for shared governance of the university. Now, the university is going to operate under a strategic plan. The strategic plan was 100% faculty. 8 people, all on the faculty, no deans, no provosts, no vice provosts, no vice presidents on the group. Ed Lawler, 6 other faculty from Ithaca, and 1 faculty from Weill Cornell. You asked Ed Lawler if I rewrote any part of that. He asked me to read it. I made some grammatical corrections and pointed out a few things that I hoped would be in there. That's a faculty product, and it's that document that was taken to the Board of Trustees for an all-day retreat, not the 20 task forces and the BAM work and everything. It was a strategic plan developed by a faculty member.
But faculty appointed members. Not faculty chosen as faculty. But to represent the faculty's own instincts and expertise.
But the faculty's own instincts and expertise are going to vary according to the area. So let's say you picked a group that the faculty developed. Let's just say you picked 8 people and they were elected, not appointed, popularly elected. And they came out and they had a strategic plan. And let's say there was a third way of doing it. Let's say that I wrote the strategic plan from top to bottom. My assertion, I don't mean to be combative, but my assertion is that 80% of those plans would be superimposable. We'd all say diversity is important. We'd all say student access is important. We'd all say that faculty hiring and autonomy and defense of the tenure system is important. So let's be really honest with each other. We don't have major disconnects on these major issues across campus. We don't. Where we have disconnects, I believe, in this 31 years in higher education, we've had probably less time than that, but whatever time you've had, that We have disconnects on areas where there is an inflection in a curve, where there's a change in the curve, and something upsetting is happening. We want to re-correct the shift. We're all going to have a different idea about how to do that. For example, you and I agree that the budget model hasn't worked, that we've gotten over-leveraged and so on and so forth. Your question is, how are we going to make the budget model work? And you don't like the fact that the particular model that was developed, you believe, is too centralized. The former provost and 32-year member of the faculty here says it's way too peripheral, it's not centralized enough. So we're going to have a phase where we're going to argue like crazy across the campus about the budget model. We're going to try it. We'll have more corrections and so on. While that's going on, we're all going to agree that we're going to pour money into diversity, student access, professorships. We're going to cut back on the infrastructure funding on campus. So I think in the main, we're not going to disagree on those areas at all. But to make the corrections in minority areas where there are minority of areas, where there are very healthy disagreements, I think we need to put attention on that. That's not to say that we should assume that everybody will agree with diversity and student access and faculty autonomy and tenure, but I bet the vast majority would. So what I would like to do in a time of great duress, honestly, is focus our attention as a community on areas where we need to come to a consensus and not pretend that we're at diametric poles where most of the stuff we're going to agree on. Most stuff we're going to agree on. The majority of the money spent under the new budget model will be spent under local authority, not by the provost. And if that didn't come across clearly, please bring the provost back and have him talk to you again. Bring both of us back. Spend a whole meeting on that, because that's actually how it works. Please. And in terms of the governance, and how you want me to work with governance, you know I'm at your service. That's the reason I want to come. You know it's a very high priority. But we have to find a way to reconcile these two areas, where people in a certain area will justifiably say, we're not paying enough attention to the social sciences, or I believe the humanities. And that means somebody more central in the university has to decide to divert resources into that area. There's no other way to do it.
But the larger that group, the better the decision.
You can't make that decision with 40 people. It just doesn't work. A social scientist will know that better than anybody.
If you have 10 people, it's better than one.
We do have 10 people. We do have 10 people.
If those people are chosen by diverse constituencies and represent different points of view, that's the superiority of deliberation.
I agree.
Over autocratic decisions.
I agree with it, but I bristle at the use of the word autocratic. I bristle at it. Can I tell you why? Because if it was autocratic, you wouldn't even have heard about the faculty group in strategic plan. There are places where the president and the provost just say, here's what y'all are going to be doing for the next 5 years, and it doesn't work. It doesn't work at all. So I think it's perhaps it's a choice of words that makes me react more strongly than I ought to.
It's a political science.
It could be. But I mean, it's a term that has some specificity. I don't think anything about the way Kent Fox is doing this is autocratic. I'm not defending my choice.
But autocratic was Hunter Raleigh deciding all by himself to bulldoze those dress like this. And there's been other decisions.
You know, I don't know what to say about that. But except I'm not defending Hunter Rollins. I mean, I've known him longer than you all have, but I'm not defending him. The only thing I'm saying is that right now, in the teeth of this hurricane that happily is calming down, I really think the direction that things are going are more faculty-centric. More shared governance centric, I really do. And I think that the current administration and university, and I'm not counting myself, I'm not saying this to be self-serving, I think the mood is to listen to the shared governance bodies, I really do. I think there's abundant evidence of that. I do think in some areas there's no room for broad community discussion occasionally. For example, I was going to put those fences up on the bridges no matter what anybody told me, because it's my specialty, I know a lot about it, and I wasn't going to stand by and watch the seventh kid jump off the bridge while we had some big campus debate. There's only two times in my career that I've done that, both at Cornell. The other one was student financial aid, approving Biddy's idea that we had to up that financial aid. Everything else is up for grabs. We can talk about it until the cows come home. That's more of an Iowa term. until the presidents come home. But I agree with you. I just think that we have to find a way to reconcile. I agree with you that shared governance, the more the better. But we have to agree that there are some times in which a decision has to be made for the greater good of the whole campus or a subset of the campus. I just don't know, and I'm glad to learn from a political scientist how to do that efficiently and quickly. Our government doesn't do it. I don't know any government anywhere that does it. once in a while you have to have executive privilege to make those decisions. I would submit.
Life and death in times of war and response to attack. Like how many wars have we been involved in this country that did not involve?
You know, okay. honestly, I think with it, no. I actually think it's important. Just one more minute, I'm out of here. I think we were in such dire straits financially 18 months ago. War is a thing that's not relevant to a campus. I think we were in such straits 18 months ago that some immediate things had to be done from the top. And I think that it was clumsy that I had a across-the-board 4.9% budget cut, but we began to return toward a time where we can right the ship. And I believe that we've had a lot of terrific dialogue that I learned a lot from you about the campus. I think the fascinating thing is that it's gone a lot in the ways that you have talked to me about by email and otherwise. We're not spending money on construction projects now, much, much, much less than we were, $600 million less than was planned. And that money is going into people, not buildings. That was by somebody in 300 day hall deciding we just ain't going to do it anymore. And, you know, there has to be balance between them. I agree with you. And I would love to talk to you. I'd love to talk to you about two things if you want to. The budget model, you can hate it still, but just to make sure you understand what it means and where the funds will flow. And secondly, if you want to talk about the future shared governance, I'm at your service, but it's very, very important. So forgive me, I just wanted to engage you directly.
Well, thank you ever so much for coming and taking the time to engage with us.
Oh, this is so important to me, and very, very, very important. Stay after me on this until you're satisfied. And if you can find time to talk about the budget, what do you want to meet with me? Just look at the clock.
Thank you.
See you guys. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'd like to actually say something that has to do when President Scorton talked in Colorado Forum about a year ago about the budget crisis, there was one thing that I really appreciated that he did autocratically, and that was he was accepted responsibility for the budget shortfall, for him planning to overspend, and I actually liked that.
No, he accepted responsibility as an executive area, being the fault of an administrative mistake.
And in some cases, for not seeing what was about to happen before it happened sooner.
Yeah.
Well, I think he said that it was spending beyond their means, in a sense. It was what is it called, deficit financing, with the view that it was going to continue to expand. And that's what he said was an improper. Bankers made that mistake.
All right. Could we continue with our agenda? I think we're now to the talk about the labor action. Are we?
We have a resolution.
We have a resolution.
The CJC resolution.
The CJC resolution. Are you going to present that, Cade?
Yes, I will. These are also from CJC and John Sedovic. Since he could not be here today, he also wrote a letter explaining, but I'll quickly go through the, I believe, four changes. The first one that we're, does everyone have a copy of?
We have consolidated.
Okay. The first one involves paving, and it was originally brought up by Tim Marcel, and he just basically asked that Cornell's definition of paving be a little more expansive than fit national standards. So the only line added was regardless of a person's consent to participate. Do you have a comment on that specifically? It's fairly straightforward, all the changes. The second one was actually recommended by the JA's office. The issue there is that currently they have a 60-day statute of limitations for fraud cases, and that fraud cases involve like investigation made for offices, so oftentimes they run out of statute of limitations before their investigation is completed. The JAA's office actually recommended increasing that to 1 year, but the CJC unanimously decided to extend it to 3 years, so they would have a very large net to work with, and the statute of limitations wouldn't be an issue in the future.
So that originally had an extension of the statute of limitations for rape or sexual assault as well, and that somehow disappeared.
of that.
Do you know anything about that?
I am not familiar with that specific statute of limitations.
It did come up in the CJC, and there were some concerns that other offenses, as you get further away from the date of the offense, it becomes harder to have a the whole idea with statute of limitations being that over time the evidence becomes less reliable, and the possibility of a fair hearing becomes less reliable because of that. So they felt that Prague was in a unique situation where extra time was important, and in other situations it was not as important.
I would still say that the extra time for a woman perhaps to realize that she was raped before she can press charges is at least as important as Prague.
The judicial administrator might agree with you there, but the committee did not.
I have a question. So, say if I was allegedly committed fraud and 60 days passed and nothing happened?
That would probably be a question for Ari, but bound by...
So if I'm allegedly accused of fraud and it goes beyond 60 days, so nothing happens to me?
I think that this has to do with the extension of the amount of time before the term is charged, but before the JA approaches you about the offense.
It just says the alleged fraud, though, like from the alleged fraud.
Can I see a copy of it? I don't remember the language
exactly. I'm just wondering if it goes beyond the 60 days, then I don't know if a charge is dropped or nothing happens or what. Has anybody gotten away with it?
Got something worse for you?
No. I'm just using okay for you. I'm using myself as an example of having another routine.
So you're saying currently it says 60 calendar days from the discovery of the alleged fraud.
So with the 51 days or 70 days, what happened?
They can't do it.
Doesn't stay.
Okay.
You know who that is?
I assume the CJC has looked into these matters, and they have, it's full of a bunch of lawyers, so I think we should not try and second-guess them except on general principle. And what they're basically doing is extending the statute of limitations so that if somebody commits a fraud and it's discovered a year later, you still do something about it, whereas if it's...
I understand that. I'm just saying if in the past... how it's currently written, what happens if they don't start the investigation?
Well, look, Leon, it says here it has 3 years from the discovery of alleged fraud, which could be that a year after the fraud takes place, it's discovered.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have 3 years beyond that period.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's discovered.
All right. All right.
Yeah. So we go on to the next?
Yeah, moving on to the third one. It moves the start of the hearing board's terms of office. Right now they start at the beginning of the academic year and it moves it to June 1st. The reason behind that is that there are instances where the hearing board needs to convene over the summer or cases, and this ensures the availability that everyone is seated already. So the second part of that actually goes with part four is the e-board of the UA. We temporarily have to make emergency appointments as they come and as availabilities open up on the hearing board, so this basically just codifies that, and it also does that in, I think we all have the same copy, at the top line to address any emergency. Again, that goes along with part three about terms of office, and then the fourth part just actually makes it official that the executive committee has that power.
And then we did change the number of students to 25, right?
Yeah, we just did that.
Five members and 25 students.
Jim, I think you were next.
Is there a definition of what constitutes an emergency in the eye of the board? Or, I mean, as a sentence, it sounds great, but what's an emergency and who decides?
The emergency is usually brought on by the JA's office. RE notifies us that they have an immediate appointment that they need to fill. Is that...
It, you know, it helps clarify for the record, an emergency is a situation where there aren't enough hearing review board members available to convene a panel, and a panel needs to be convened within a certain number of days of the events being reported. So any situation where to fulfill the due process responsibilities, more members are needed.
Understood.
Good.
I second this resolution.
Is there more to it, Kate?
That's it. Changes.
All right. We have it's moved and seconded. Is there any discussion? No. Then all in favor of this motion? All opposed to the motion? All abstentions? Once again, a cliffhanger.
Marty. I have a point of clarification about what occurred earlier in the meeting. I was not certain that we have. I know we voted on the ombudsman, we voted on the CJC counselor, or the judicial counselor. I wasn't certain that we voted on all of these nominations to the hearing and review board.
Yeah.
Did we? We passed.
Did this right here, Marty?
That.
Yes, we did. We passed it.
We passed it.
We voted.
That was the first page
and then the second page was the changing of the numbers.
Right.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Okay, we've been rather expeditious, and so let's talk about the labor motion, whoever is going to present that.
I'm sorry, I don't have any paper copy for all of you.
Are we going to have a dramatic reading?
Yeah. I could do that, or I could pass it around, whichever.
I think it's going to be easier if you just read it.
Sure. I'll sit and score and see.
Please.
More than that.
Do you have any setup you need to let us know about so that we understand what we're going to be read?
In the whereas policy. It'll explain it.
We might be able to set you up with a table, so if you want me to.
That would be incredible. But this resolution was passed by a vote of 18-0-1 in the student assembly yesterday, and it's in regards to Nike's actions in Honduras, or its subcontractors' actions in Honduras. Nike subcontractors closed down two factories in Honduras, leaving 1,700 workers unemployed. It did not pay them their required severance pay, nor in one factory were they even paid for their last week of work. Additionally, a few months beforehand, starting in August, the factory owners began to take the deductions from workers' wages that are mandated by Honduran law to go to their Medicare system, their health insurance system, and instead pocketed those and didn't pay them. And because of that, workers were denied emergency care. And one worker, a few months after the factory closing, actually died of cancer because she couldn't get treatment. So our code of conduct, this will all be explained in a second, but our code of conduct that we signed on to in 2003 states that all licensees need to be responsible for their subcontractors' actions. And as we see that Nike subcontractors were with. Oh, there we go.
Can you get the left hand?
Can you get that a little bigger? Yeah.
I need the right hand.
Has Nike responded in any way?
Yes. Mind if I read the resolution and then?
Sure.
Yeah. Or I guess you guys can see it, but.
I'll
try to do it dramatically. So. Whereas on January 19th, 2009, two apparel factories, Hugger de Honduras and Vision Tech in Honduras, shut down without prior warning, leaving 1,700 workers unemployed. Whereas the factory owners did not pay severance compensation required by Honduran law, the workers are still owed about $2.2 million. This is an average of $1,300 per worker, equivalent to 7 months of their base salary. Whereas the owners of the factory were required by Honduran law to deduct a portion of workers' wages and pay that money to the National Health Insurance System, starting in August 2008, the factory owners continued to deduct wages, but instead of sending the money to the IHSS, they pocketed it. The workers only found out about this practice when one was denied emergency care. Because of the lack of access to medical care, one worker could not get treatment for cancer and died a few months after the factory closing. Whereas from 2000 to 2006, nearly every product made in Hugger was Nike apparel. from 2007 to 2008. 60% of the Hugger clothing was Nike apparel. From 2007 to 2008, over 80% of the clothing made in Vision Techs was Nike apparel. Whereas Nike's own code of conduct states, when we look at our overall footprint in the world, the needs of nearly 800,000 workers in our contract supply chain overshadow any other group, what we've learned after nearly a decade is that monitoring alone hasn't solved our problems. Whereas the collegiate licensing company's code of conduct, to which Cornell is a party, stipulates that licensees are responsible for the conduct of their contractors, subcontractors, and manufacturers. And whereas this code of conduct further stipulates that companies that license from the university are expected to comply with local labor laws. Whereas both subcontractors have continuously violated Honduran law, inflicting a huge moral cost on thousands of workers and their families. Whereas Cornell, along with 46 other universities, has endorsed the principles of the designated supplier program, which states that licensees like Nike must hold their subcontractors to the same standards they hold themselves. He has therefore resolved that the student assembly believes Nike has violated the university's code of conduct. He has finally resolved that the student assembly recommends the university sever its contracts with Nike unless the company realigns its business practices with the university's code of conduct. Obviously, the resolution we'd introduce here would be the same, except it's a university assembly. And 28 organizations endorsed it when it was introduced in the student assembly yesterday.
Are those the same 28 organizations endorsing it for
the Yes, it's the same resolution. They've endorsed our principle, our recommendation.
Okay, so we have a resolution on the table. Are there any seconds?
Does anyone want to discuss it? I'll second it.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded, so is there any discussion? Sure.
Two questions. The first, where do we get our facts? I mean, they're very compelling if they're true.
Yes.
But who has vetted the facts, and why do we believe them to be true? The second would be recommend, if it's not corrected, that do we sever ties? Do we have a time frame that should be added to that, or you know, or some suitable language that would actually give us an enforcement tripwire to recommend actually following through on the be it finally resolved?
Sure. So to your first question, where the facts come from, the parts about Nike's own code of conduct come from their own website. The facts about the factory, such as the amount that they're owed is from the Honduran Labor Ministry. I should go by fact, but I should say that the majority of these facts come from the Workers' Rights Consortium reports, which is an independent monitoring agency that Nike and many other companies use to inspect their factories and make sure they're up to their own standards.
This information has been all over the media in the past, the New York Times, PBS, it's been everywhere, CNN, so it's you know what I mean? Overman, it's been everywhere.
Yeah. Nike isn't already denying, and this has been around, Nike isn't denying the facts of the charges.
So Nike originally denied that they used the subcontractors, then they turned around on that position. Nike originally denied that collegiate apparel was made, and they turned around on that position. They're disputing the exact percentages of what was used. They say that only 43% of Vision Tech's clothing was Nike, whereas the Workers' Rights Consortium found 80. But they're not denying that the workers are owed money, the charges about what the subcontractors did. Their main argument is that they don't see any responsibility because it was a subcontractor. To your second question about enforcement, the university, or Mike Powers, who's head of communications and licensing, has set up a separate committee, the Cornell University Licensing Oversight Committee, which President Scorton said will follow their recommendations. But we've been going around to the student assembly and to this assembly just to get more of a recommendation as for what Scorton should do. We're not here to argue for an exact implementation plan as of yet, but more of a recommendation that our codes of conduct are actually followed.
Could you scroll down to the therefore be it resolved?
Sure, sure.
Because I can't remember what.
Sure.
Thank you.
I also think it's more relevant to us because we have direct legislative oversight over the campus store. Mm-hmm.
Is it the closing of Silver at the campus door or closing use in the athletic department? Where is Cornell in this?
Sure, it's actually both. There are two contracts that Cornell has with Nike. The first is just a licensing contract that gives them permission to make clothes with Cornell on it that are sold in the bookstore and in their stores. The second one is a contract to supply a lot of our athletic gear, which actually ran out this year. And athletics, instead of bidding and seeing who else can apply, just wants to go immediately into another contract with Nike. And so we were saying, first of all, at least ask for other bids, but then second of all, because of their labor standards, we think that Nike isn't our choice going forward.
We had asked, whereas, how can Nike say that they're not responsible for this subcontract?
That's a very good question. their claim has simply been that subcontract, their exact quote was that the relationship between employee and employer is very special, and they don't want to step into that, with the quote from Amanda Ducker, who's head of corporate social responsibility at Nike.
Did they directly address that?
There was a conference call with the Cornell University Licensing Oversight Committee about 3 weeks ago.
What are the consequences to the athletic department if certain things that Nike makes that they depend on are not available? Have you looked into that at all?
Sure. Of course. That's what the committee has been focusing on. So with the athletics department, the goal is to find another contract, not to leave our athletes to compete naked, obviously.
Without padding.
our contention is not to get our athletes naked. The value of the contract, athletics has refused to provide an exact copy of the contract, but by their own estimates, the contract benefits athletics in the amount of about $300,000 in terms of what's been provided. And if it were to be continued, that would be how much they would like to get in terms of just where that money comes from, discounted items that they can buy. They can buy shoes for their athletes at wholesale prices, as well as discounted making of jerseys and such. And so our argument, as I said, was that to ask Under Armour or Adidas, who are the two other biggest suppliers of athletics departments to collegiate to colleges, make offers or get offers from them, ask for bids, and go forward. But the main thing is that we think it's a pretty clear violation of our code of conduct, and we think that something needs to be taken of that. And we're aware there are consequences, but we think our code of conduct should be upheld.
Randy? Can the last whereas be written into the contract, or is it already written into the contract?
The designated suppliers program? So that is a program that Cornell signed on to in principle, that is trying to be developed right now, where it would require that universities source their uniforms, all of their materials, from mostly factories that pass WRC inspections and uphold certain labor standards. So it's a program that has not been set up in its implementation form yet nationally, but one that we've endorsed the principles of and we are working to enforce. So we think it'd be great if that were implemented and again suggested, but that's not yet set up to enforce it. So it's more the principles today.
Jim? Two other quick, first, I see they respectfully submitted, but somebody obviously initiated this.
Sure.
Are there any known conflicts of interest with this? I mean, the people submitted aren't from Adidas, Nike, just because when you do this publicly, then you get press, and then you find out.
No, of course. I get the people that sponsored it in the University Assembly were Vincent Andrews, the president-elect, and Phil Eden.
And we have no reason to believe, and I'm sure we don't, but I'm just asking an intelligent question. Does anybody know of any conflicts of interest?
Only with Nike are there conflicts of interest.
Okay. And the second is this student assembly. So do we have a resolution before us, or are we waiting for the slight wording changes to the university assembly, or are we trying to do a sense of we support the student assembly's resolution? What is the before us?
What would you like?
Just one word.
Yeah, so ideally, if we could just change student to university,
we'd submit the exact same resolution before you. But we do want an independent analysis from you guys.
Okay. Yes, Elizabeth.
No, actually, behavior has been so egregious on these issues, it's surprising any university sports. I've seen PBS programs on this. It seems well documented that they're really awful. But this was a follow-up to Jim's question, because, you know, people may ask, if it was a workers' rights consortium that oversees these problems and identifies them, is that, I take it that's not part of the ILO, but where does this organization come from?
Sure.
Who constitutes it?
Sure. Well,
why should people see it as a threat?
Sure. Well, that's an independent organization that was set up. Actually, Bill could tell you more about that, but I believe it was set up in
1997.
Or 2003. Oh, 2003, correct.
But it wasn't initiated with the International Labor Organization of the United Nations or any such universal body.
So that organization came about it was established by the part of the United Students Against Russia, so the student movement that was kind of disappointed in the fact that there's no transparency in the apparel supply chain. So prior to the student effort, Nike did not disclose where the factories are, and it is made or where they were operating. And it wasn't only until like after student advocacy and the student investigations and kind of bringing it to PBS, essentially in real time, bringing it to the public light, until they actually started doing what we say is morally right, like what a responsible business should do. So that is, this is just a continuation of it. That is, it's a totally independent thing. So the Workers' Rights Consortium is funded by universities to adopt the principles of a designated suppliers program.
Okay.
So they will pay a small percentage of the licensing fee into that. And then that goes to pay for the independent monitoring of the factories.
And if I may, Mike Powers actually sits on the board of the Workers' Rights Consortium. Works in communications and is head of licensing at Cornell. So it's made up of people from universities, independent outsiders. But I think the most important thing is that what Nike disputes is the percentages of how much clothing was made there, and not that there was a violation of Honduran law. Their main dispute is in terms of responsibility for it.
The people who ultimately pay for this are the people who would actually be taking the apparel factories. Like the question, and so the people who adopt these principles, they are going ahead. They pay into this because they feel like this is something that they're like, this is an issue that they're concerned about, and this is like directly affecting the clothes that they say, like it's affecting their name. Like we support this, and we want to actually see that what we are saying is correct, and we don't want to do it by any, like we don't want to have someone's word. We would like to have our own word, and we want to have our own investigation.
Okay, could we proceed with the? We're running out of time.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Can I have a motion to extend the time by 15 minutes?
Everybody in agreement? Okay, we're golden. Is there further discussion of this of this motion? All right. All in favor of the motion? All opposed? Abstaining? Once again, another cliffhanger. Good. And we have extended time by 15 minutes, so we have about 15 minutes to talk about the productive role of the University Assembly and the charter amendments. And Ed, do you want to lead that to begin with?
Yes, so I think I sent everybody that the both the employee assembly or the employee election as well as the student election reached the 20% voter turnout, which is the impressive part to begin
with,
and passed. So we got a majority vote on each of those, and now we're just waiting on the faculty.
May 1st?
I don't know when the faculty election.
Oh, it's gone out, but I don't know what the results are, and it's going to take a while. I think it's the 10th of May,
was the deadline, wasn't it?
I voted as soon as it came.
So
I don't remember when the deadline was.
And we won't find out. Another note, that, so that everybody knows, that when we extended it for the students, the exec committee and the Office of the Assemblies, I communicated with this. We had no idea what the vote was looking like. We just decided to extend the election to get to the 20% mark and then see what the results look like. So we did it on the utmost. So it's kind of, we're thinking that since it's the last meeting of the year, some people will be staying, some people will be leaving, and this body has been engaged in this conversation this year. And the edits have been online. Hopefully people have taken a look at it. What people think would be the place, the role, what legislative authority the assembly, this assembly, this body should have next year when we hopefully are able to make substantial changes to the charter for the first time. So,
Well, I think it's great that we might, you know, after, what's the employee election next? Is that the last one?
No, faculty.
That we will be able to make these changes. I'm just wondering if, anyone has asked about the ethics of extending the election just to get the votes.
This has been brought up, and I know I personally did think about it. We all did. We wrote a letter explaining the reason for the extension, explaining why we needed the 20% vote to read for a valid thing. And this was the important factor that the extension happened with us having no idea how the vote was trending even. So it was simply giving people more time to vote, become aware of the issues, and giving them the access to be able to see it. So yeah, it was an issue that was thought about. So I personally have no compelling argument why that would have been a wrong thing to do.
Once you extended it, did you get any negative feedback?
Of course there was negative feedback, lots of emails. The Office of Assemblies definitely got emails saying, stop bugging us.
I wouldn't say lots, though.
Yeah.
Handful.
It's not just a handful. I communicated with one graduate student who had a question exactly as what you're saying, is why would the extension, and explained to her why we did it and that we didn't know how the vote was going, and I haven't heard back from her again, so I'm assuming from silence that she understood that.
In my opinion, the ethical breach would have been if then we started putting up poster boards, radio ads during the extension saying, you should vote for X.
Yeah.
And versus, have you voted?
Yeah. And if you go back and read the Sun article that said the exec board co-signed that I wrote, nowhere in that did it say vote yes on this.
Right.
It was a here's or why, no. Here's the right. Issues. We were very careful not to sort of shove down somebody's throat.
At the time that you did that, what was the faculty percentage at voting at that time?
Not the student percentage.
The student percentage.
We were close. We were approaching, I don't remember the exact percentage, but I think we were
within 600 votes out of the 4,053 that we needed.
That's so
it's also based on our office has received a good number of emails back. I would say like somewhere between 10 and 20 emails from various students who didn't want to be contacted about voting anymore because they didn't appreciate receiving a lot of email about it. And as far as I know, most of them decided not to vote through the end of the election.
Yeah.
But I think that, that's a consideration too, that if we got that close to it and there wasn't a sufficient turnout, it hasn't really been rejected by referendum either. It's just that the referendum wouldn't have been valid and we would have had to start all over again. And the 20 people would probably be upset to be emailed again. In the
20 people out of 20,000. Yeah. Pretty good.
Yeah. So I think it would be really good to get an idea of just if anybody had thoughts of what the role of this assembly, several people have been on here for several years, we're potentially looking at changing significant pieces, membership, legislative authority, what issues we cover. Where do you see this body having a role? Like, do we still have oversight over the campus bookstore? United Religious Works, maybe yes. What are people's opinions on this thing?
One thing that when people were asking me, because I was very active in my department,
among a group of friends was telling people to vote was what are the checks and balances? And so I think that maybe that might be a consideration that needs to be.
Make sure that's the.
Sorry, what do you mean by? Well, that if the charter is being changed and it is a representative group, at what point does this group have too much administrative executive power within this room? But what protects and balances beyond that? And I guess I'll just tell them it's you.
Just the president.
Yes, well, the president.
When we vote, Elizabeth off the island.
You know, but I do think it's important to that some of us are leaving to and handing on the role that to know something about the various industry, which is new for a lot of you, and that is that I think the UA was really rejuvenated as a result of the Redwood controversy in the whole university and the county, the big part of it, and the town and the city government and everybody were really against this, and yet, you know, we lost big. But there was a real mobilization there and a desire to bring more deliberation and more input, especially more faculty and students, staff and city input into big decisions that Cornell made that affected everybody. And so that was that first fall after 2005 was a big one. But almost immediately the university came down with this new code of conduct, just Zoom, and you know this the co-judicial committee of the UA had authority to instigate amendments to the code, and yet the university had just plopped here. We want to redo the whole code of conduct and take away rights to counsel and all sorts of other things and have a difference. They called it a re-education model rather than a sort of Anglo-American legal system.
Well, Elizabeth, so that may all be true, but the fact of the matter is that it came to the Codes and Judicial Committee, which agonized long and hard about all of it, and then brought it up through the University Assembly, which voted on it, passed it on to the President, and the majority of our recommendations were accepted.
Well, exactly. But that's
and so
I think that was a great, well, it worked. But you know, in the UA before 2005, they probably have gotten away with it. I think that showed that move on the code, especially after the huge loss on the Redwood, except that there were some valuable things that were instituted as a result of Redwood, but concerned with sustainability and all that. I think that was a great victory. Even the administration handing down very autocratically, if I may use that word, just having sort of secretly come up with a whole new code of conduct that affected everybody here and our rights here and so on. And a lot of people thought it was, to get to that they were trying to come up with a better way to squelch dissent. Who knows? But the University Assembly just put an end to that, and there was huge protest, and UA said, no, this is our function, and it was very gratifying to see. The law students were really wonderful here, and they came through, and they provided, a lot of expertise to the movement. But that was a success. The administration got a few changes, but that, I think, showed the importance of the UA and what the UA could do and why it's here. And I hope that those of you who continue, after some of us, original rebel rousers or not, will keep up the role of watching for autocratic decisions that need to have more discussion on campus.
Is there other ideas, Andy?
But yeah. I think the original point was, at what point does University Assembly then become the autocratic force?
Well,
but that's, I'm just telling you what I heard.
Right.
A legitimate concern from someone who's interested enough to vote.
Right.
The 20 that did.
Yeah, some people were concerned about the fact that we were getting rid of this this part of the charter that gives a referendum to the people. I see our checks and balances as being whatever we pass, it doesn't matter unless President Scorn agrees with it. Like, that's the real check and balance. But in terms of what I think we should be improving, I don't think the main source of our problems comes from the structure of our own charter. I think it's our own internal operations. Like, I think that perhaps organizing the committees and making sure they're active and appointing, from this room a chairman of each committee or something like that, and then staying in touch with a Google document about goals each one of us wants to accomplish throughout the year, would make it more of a, we only get one every 2 weeks, one of these meetings. And a lot of times it's just the CJC sent us something, let's check it off like today. But I think that we could be more effective if we do have control over our own committees and we are talking outside of this room with like a Google document, something like that.
Okay, good suggestion. Any others?
Could I just point out to political scientists that, that autocratic power is a term that is almost exclusively used for the executive branch, and they're the people who need checking. They have 99.9% of the power over everything at this university, and UA is one little tiny bit of a wedge for a broader discussion. So it, I mean, it really is crazy to talk about us being too powerful. And we're
I respectfully listen to that. You like the term autocratic. I'm just saying that that was a concern that was brought to me. I know it's the onus of me to bring it back in terms that you understood. We can talk about offline if you'd like, but I said what I
needed to say. And the concern was raised by your
students. A concern was raised by a graduate student.
Do you have any particular thing in mind?
I think that we can discuss this to death within this forum, and we only have like 4 more minutes, so if you want to discuss me personally, we can do that.
And it's just very
curious.
So one thing that I've been thinking a lot about is what would be the legislative authority which would then guide what committees we have and what committees we need to dissolve away. One thing that has come to me is maybe the issue of sustainability, that this is something that affects the whole campus community. Maybe through communication with administration, we may be able to get some legislative authority on the things of sustainability policies. Is there any other things which people here see as factors which won't just affect undergrads or faculty members, but affect the community at large? This is the body that may want to consider legislative authority over.
I think that we need to make sure there's, you know, we have a chairman, and then we should have some person who's like organizing the internal operations, making sure people are on top of the committees and, you know, going to those meetings. But I also think before we throw out everything and rewrite it, we should check in with, you know, religious work or the campus store and all those other committees and make sure, see if, you know, maybe there's a chance where there's some good changes we can make through those committees before we, you know, get rid of them.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I didn't say much.
I had the fortune of having lunch with a couple of the people yesterday who drafted the original charter for the University Senate back in the in 1970s. And it kind of made me think about you know, this exercise right here and what used to happen. At then the university was in a constant state of flux. Even when the UA charter was drafted, the university was in a constant state of flux. And right now, you know, as we go through the whole reimagining Cornell process, brand new state of flux. So I think it's certainly worthwhile to look at the past, look at the organizations that the UA has kind of had legislative authority over the past, see how we can kind of reuse that, recycle that, turn it into something new and healthy, like the folks of the world or whatnot. But as Ed said, I think there's a number of opportunities, as the university starts to reshape the future, to really start to plan out what certain units of the university that really need, this combined community voice in shaping what those units do in the future.
Like, I think there's a very good corollary there, actually. The Faculty Senate has a mechanism for essentially appointing the committees. There's the nominations and elections. And the committees are creatures of the Senate. And so there is a good relationship, I think, between the committees. Most of the work of the Senate goes on in the various committees, which is then comes to the general body, the university faculty, for discussion, where much of the time it's rubber stamped the way things were here today. But on some occasions there are vigorous dissenting points of view. And it seems to me that as a general model, that's not a bad one. And there are, what I think we ought to give some real consideration to is the various areas of the university where we feel the university assembly should be particularly vigilant. I mean, we've spent a lot of time on the child care situation, and that seems to me an entirely appropriate thing for the university assembly, because it affects all
a little less the undergraduates, to be sure, but basically it's for the whole community. The transportation issues clearly affect the whole community, and there seems to me a variety of those things. And I think that over the summer, since this is, I guess, our last meeting, we should be thinking about what those areas are. Take a look at the charter and kind of prioritize which of these we think are the most important and start in on those.
And I think with those two areas, we already do have legislative control over those things. It's just a matter of getting those committees active and, you know, one of us being a liaison to each of them.
Yes.
But I think what Ed and Trustee Walsh are saying right now is that maybe we should be brainstorming new areas such as sustainability and stuff like that. And yeah, I guess we'll think about it over the summer.
Yep. Well, with that, I think we've come to the end of our time, and I would suggest that we adjourn.
Second.
With many thanks to everybody.
Second.
Are you with us here?
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.